Hospital.
May it please the court, Charles Paternoster of Parsons, Farnell & Grine in Portland, Oregon, on behalf of Dr. Michael Saluski. I'd respectfully request 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
For rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, I think that fundamentally the central question here is, do the statutory grounds exist to vacate an arbitration award under RCW 7.04A-020? Understanding this court's guidance in Cummings and other cases, that review is extremely limited and that vacation of arbitration awards happen relatively rarely. The key issue here is whether or not the arbitrator exceeded his powers, and that error of law must be on the face of the award. In this case, we do believe that we have a situation where there are purely legal issues before the court. There's an eternal inconsistency in the arbitrator's award that is recognizable on the face of the award that justifies vacating it.
Can the owners of a small business agree among themselves not to compete for a period of time in geographic area after the business dissolves or any one of them leaves the business?
I think they can, but then there's a separate question, I think, about whether or not, Your Honor, that qualifies as consideration for an individual employment agreement between one of those individuals and the entity itself. And so,
what do we do, though, with the determination on the face of the award that every time a new shareholder came into this professional services corporation, all shareholders signed a new non-compete agreement, even though that takes the form of an individual? Doesn't that, on the face of the award, satisfy our inquiry?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because, again, I don't think the mere fact that other shareholders sign separate and independent agreements with the company qualifies as the kind of independent and separate consideration required for a modification under Labriola. Again, the mere fact that you have other individuals who are parties to separate contracts also signing those contracts, I don't think provides independent and separate consideration for Dr. Saluski's agreement with Pilchuck in this case. And I think it splits. I think there are two different pieces to the analysis. One is the issue that you mentioned, which is, do the promises of shareholders or kind of independent shareholders in and of themselves qualify as consideration? I think there's a separate piece of it as well, which is, does that qualify as separate and independent consideration for a subsequent modification under Labriola? For example, if in fact the 2005 agreement was the exact same terms, the exact same situation among the shareholders, only perhaps different or additional shareholders signed, what is it that Pilchuck is giving back in the way of consideration in the substantive agreement, or in the subsequent agreement, that qualifies as additional or independent consideration for that modification?
Well, if he was a mere employee at the time, that would be an argument under Labriola. But in wearing the hat of being one of those shareholders who all in concert signed the same agreement early on, midstream, toward the tail end of the existence of the business, why isn't that just adequate consideration?
Well, and again, I think that it's not because those individuals, the other shareholders, aren't parties to Dr. Saluski's agreement. I think that there's a third problem, which is, while that happens in 2007, you then have Dr. Saluski returning to the position of an employee in 2008. And so there's an additional problem, which is, while there is a stock redemption agreement that is referred to in the arbitration award that is signed in late 2008, there is no, again, separate consideration nor anything else related to a non-compete agreement that's entered into at that time when Dr. Saluski becomes an employee. All that happens is that stock redemption agreement in late 2008 simply says, and any other agreements remain in effect.
Including the 2000.
And it specifically references or cites the 2007 employment agreement.
Well, if there was consideration at the time the 2007 agreement was entered into, which I understand you're arguing there wasn't, but if there was, what difference does it make that he's now had his shares bought out and is back to the role of an employee?
I think, Your Honor, that at that point in time, there's either got to be a new non-competition agreement with Dr. Saluski as employee, or there's got to be additional separate and independent consideration under Labriola to basically make that new 2008 employment relationship with a non-compete effective.
Does the stock redemption agreement provide consideration?
I don't believe it does, and in fact, the language of the stock redemption agreement indicates that there isn't any other additional consideration that is being provided pursuant to the terms of the agreement. What you'll see from the arbitrator's award is the only reference whatsoever to the previous January 2007 agreement is just, in essence, an appendix that says this agreement remains in effect. And so I don't believe there's additional independent consideration that flows from that agreement nearly 2 years later.
And, your argument about liquidated damages, you know, it seems like the arbitrator may have been slightly colloquial in discussing that, but says, hey, this, in the question of whether this has there's reasonable forecast of potential damages. This wasn't rammed down the throats, as he said, of the shareholders. They all got together and signed on it. And if you look at how much gets paid out to the redeeming shareholder of a couple hundred thousand, maybe 300,000 is in the ballpark.
Well, I guess I respectfully disagree with that conclusion simply because I think that what the arbitrator was getting at, certainly in his award, was that this was something that all of the shareholders agreed to and negotiated and so on and so forth. I don't think that necessarily solves the problem of the $300,000 number, particularly when you look at the specific language of the liquidated damages clause as found in the arbitration award and ultimately the contract, which specifies $300,000 for any single violation. What you have here is a 50-mile non-compete for a veterinarian, and that 50 miles applied to anyone, whether they were previous customers, clients of the firm, or not. And then you had a broad non-mileage-based number or restriction for any other former customers or clients of the firm. And so it's an extremely broad situation. And to simply say per se that for any single violation it is a $300,000 in essence liquidated damages clause, that seems to me to be the kind of interorum or per se violation because that in no way approaches what would be the potential damages here. Understanding that the threshold certainly in terms of the analysis for liquidated damages is not to look at it after the fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning. I'm David Carson. I represent Tulchuck Veterinary Hospital, the respondents in this appeal. We reached an agreement after some number of months in court between Dr. Saluski and Tulchuck Veterinary Hospital to arbitrate this case as a means of expeditiously resolving this case. And that's how we ended up in front of Judge Thorpe, and we ended up with an arbitration decision. That decision was reconsidered by Judge Thorpe, and ultimately a final decision was prepared, presented to the Superior Court, and the judge in the Superior Court adopted that decision and gave it his blessing and sent it on. We're now here in the Court of Appeals, and we have sort of a two-step issue here, and that is, are we even properly before the Court of Appeals? Is this an appealable issue? And if it's not, then we could end this discussion here.
If the face of the award had said $300,000 to Pilchuk, period, maybe there wouldn't be anything to go forward on. But once the arbitrator articulates the specific rationale for the decision, doesn't that open the door to an argument on the face of the award there could be legal error?
I think the issue on the legal sufficiency of the arbitration awards is perhaps we don't have enough guidance as to how far off base does an arbitrator need to be before the court's going to entertain an appeal of that decision. And the instance that is provided, the example, and the only example that seems to be provided is if an award of punitive damages is given in a jurisdiction that clearly does not allow punitive damages, that would be so facially wrong that an appeal would be appropriate in the case.
If in discussing liquidated damages, the arbitrator had articulated the incorrect standard, which I'm not saying he did. I think he did correctly identify the standard. But if that got that wrong on the face of the award, wouldn't that constitute a basis for an appeal?
I'm not sure that it would. I'm not sure that merely misinterpreting the law is a basis for appealing an arbitration award. I think that the issue on arbitration is, is the policy of the state that we want to allow people to arbitrate cases and have finality to them? And the vast majority of the case law seems to be of the premise that we want, once you're into arbitration and you've agreed to arbitration, that's the last step of the procedure. And I guess as an example, just the fact that if we agree, if opposing counsel agree that we're going to arbitrate and then we're going to be able to appeal from that arbitration award, that's not an enforceable agreement. And so I guess that would be my response to it. But I'm more than happy to hit the substantive issues because, frankly, I think it's a very fascinating issue here. It's a case of first impression, and Mr. Paternoster and I have had a good time dealing with this case and discussing the potential outcomes of it. And where this case comes down to, we believe, is a difference in the scenarios where the covenant not to compete cases arise. Because where the covenant not to compete cases arise, the reported cases, is in the situation where there is a employer who has more bargaining power than the employee, and where the employer is essentially able to force a non-compete. Now, we can say that, you know, the employee has the choice and doesn't have to take the job and doesn't have to subject themselves to the burdens of a non-compete. But I think the practical reality is if we're looking at somebody who's trying to get a $12 an hour job to feed their family, to put food on the table, to pay rent, they may well sign that covenant not to compete, make a deal with the devil, regardless of the potential bad outcome of that decision. And I think that, and I think in a lot of the cases that are reported, I think what the courts have done is that they have looked for reasons to unwind those covenants not to compete. They're unfair, they're geographically unfair, their scope is burdensome, whatever it might be, to look for that reason.
We don't have any question here, though, of unreasonableness in that sense.
I don't believe so. I think that the what we have here in this situation is we have seven very intelligent, professional people, doctors, who got together, sat around the table, and said, we want to preserve the goodwill and integrity of this business. So we're willing to not compete with one another. And if we do that, if we break that promise to everyone around the table, we're willing to pay some amount of money. And that discussion took place.
Why not put that in a shareholder agreement instead of an individual employment agreement?
I think it's just the way we structured the business at that point. I mean, could it have been put into a buy-sell agreement? Perhaps. But in the situation, we put them into the individual shareholder or the employment agreements, and everybody, whenever there was a new shareholder that came in, a new employment agreement would be entered into. But I'd like to go into the corollary of that non-compete amount, that $300,000, because concurrent with that discussion was also the discussion of how much do I get when I leave here. And I guess the real issue that I see with this situation with Dr. Saluski is that Dr. Saluski was shares were redeemed out. And the redemption agreements are in there, and the non-compete agreement was mentioned in the agreement and reinforced. He accepted the benefits of that buyout, and some portion of that buyout amount is necessarily reflective of the goodwill that that company has created, that those seven doctors created and created value for that. He was paid for those shares, and he was paid a substantial amount of money for those shares. But then he wants to come back and say, even though I was paid for the goodwill of this company and you paid me a substantial amount of money, I now want to go out into the community where you have built this goodwill, where you've built this company, and I want to compete with you. And I want to
have the evidence that was presented to the arbitrator that might relate to that conversation and agreement. I guess that goes to your point of, well, we shouldn't be looking behind the face of the award to contemplate what was there or not there.
That's what I would agree with.
But what about the change? What when he goes back to a role as an employee, does that pull you back under Labriola? Then do you have to have some specific articulated consideration apart from just the fact that it, the redemption agreement recites that it continues to actually provide consideration for that as a new employee agreement?
Well, there was certainly discussion about the non-compete agreement. I can't, you know, certainly I can't get into all of those details, but the when he was bought out, the stock redemption agreement specifically referred to that, and he had all of those benefits of shareholder at that time and still had them when that accommodation was made for him, and still had the ability to impact that company through the removal of the goodwill by competing with the company.
Is the fact that he went from a shareholder to an employee yet retained this sort of buyout as a shareholder, how does that affect the consideration analysis for purposes of the non-compete and the liquidated damages clause?
Well, he's still, and that is the point, is that he's still, he received the benefit of all of that goodwill, and he was paid for it, but then he wants to go out and say, even though I was paid for it, now I want to compete and destroy that goodwill.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Absent any questions, Your Honor, I would waive my remaining 2 minutes.
All right. Thank you. The next matter.